This is Juvie, a podcast that explores cases, legislation, experiences, and ramifications of children and youth in juvenile and adult criminal justice systems.
It's very much a story of someone who feels wronged and who takes the law into his own hands and thinks he's going to be a hero. If he stood up for somebody, then he would be right. The value of loyalty, loyalty to your friends, perhaps more important than some kind of thing someone else might deem as morality. That loyalty was everything.
In 2007, Jean Traunstein got a handwritten letter mailed to her office at the community college where she taught. It was from a 31-year-old incarcerated killer. That was what she ascertained from her internet searches on his name. At first, she was apprehensive, not sure if she should respond. But the articulate and polite young man on the page didn't sound like the fury-driven 16-year-old who had apparently stormed into a classroom 14 years before and stabbed another 16-year-old, who then died of his injury. Carter Reed had found Jean Traunstein's book, Shakespeare Behind Bars, about using the medium of theatre to effect change in female prisoners' lives, in his prison library, and he was asking her for advice about a female prisoner who was coming up for parole. Traunstein initially responded with a Christmas card, promising to look into it. But the longer, grateful follow-up letter it triggered, in which Carter told her about himself and his history, had Traunstein intrigued. Who was this person? How did the stabbing happen? How come a kid was sent to prison for life with only a remote chance at parole? How could he have already lived almost half his life in prison and be expressing himself in such an honest, respectful, and eloquent manner? Thus began a now decade-long advocating relationship between prison activist, teacher, and author Jean Traunstein and second-degree murder convict Carter Kane Reed. This culminated in a book that was released in 2016 called Boy with a Knife, a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice, in which Carter's story is laid out with no soft-soaping. His family background, small-town Massachusetts cultural and social environment, his relationships with his peers, and the male adolescent norms and not always healthy influences that precipitated him towards that brutal day in April 1993 when he stabbed and killed fellow teenager Jason Robinson. Reed was eventually released in 2013, after his first chance at parole in 2008 was withdrawn when he was found to have in his possession an over-the-counter glucosamine supplement for elbow tendonitis and a six-pair surplus to the amount of allowed underwear. His release was not welcomed by all, particularly the victim's family. Following a Supreme Court ruling a year ago, there may now be many victims' families who must come to terms with the release of someone who was responsible for the loss of their loved one. This past year, the courts and the general public across the country have had to grapple with the idea that many individuals who killed when they were in their mid-teens now have the right to have their original life-without-parole sentences reviewed, and many of them will be freed back into society in the coming months and years. In January of last year, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Montgomery v. Louisiana that the unconstitutionality of mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles also be made retroactive to sentences imposed before June 2012's landmark Miller v. Alabama ruling.
Miller v. Alabama says that no child can any longer mandatorily be sentenced to automatic life without parole. Mandatorily. That doesn't mean that it can't happen, but mandatorily, that a judge no longer has to do that. That means that all states had to come to grips with their individual policies relating to how they handle the juvenile life without parole cases. Massachusetts early on passed a law in relationship to Miller. It was called the Diachenko decision, and it was Massachusetts Supreme Court saying that everybody who would be first-degree life would be eligible for parole after 15 years. That was what Diachenko said. We also made it retroactive in our state so that the cases where people were in prison already for juvenile life without parole, they could be considered for parole.
So what are we to make of all these former juveniles who killed being let free? Carter's story, which you can read about in Trounstein's book, Boy with a Knife, is a case study in how a lethally reactionary teenager can transform into a remorseful and thoughtful adult who becomes a fully functioning and positive member of society. Some detractors have accused Trounstein of downplaying Carter's crime and have given the book sardonic alternative titles, which they feel state more clearly what Carter did. But the striking book cover immediately forces us to ask uncomfortable questions. It certainly doesn't appear to be avoiding the crux of the story. Rather, it invites us to want to know more, however brutal, and however our preconceived and simplistic stereotypes might be challenged.
To me, the title is very stark. It's very honest. It seems to be very straightforward. No beating about the bush. Mm-hmm. Boy with a knife. Mm-hmm. It brings up all kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. Okay, why does he have a knife? What did he do with a knife? And then you say a story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. I was wondering about the picture, the artwork I found really interesting, him standing on top of the knife. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that idea?
I didn't do the cover of the book. A publisher has a designer, and they have the right to come up with whatever design they want, and then you approve or disapprove or make suggestions or whatever. This was the designer's idea. And what I liked about it is that, first of all, the figure, the youth, is alone in the top, and it looks like he's behind bars. And it looks like, to me, that the knife, it's all because he killed someone.
Yes.
He had this knife. Mm-hmm. In a sense, he's also the handle of the knife, and he's also the responsibility or the holder of the knife in a certain way.
The knife is bigger than he is.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's true.
Yeah.
Never thought about that, but...
Yeah. I just think artwork is really interesting.
Yeah.
It's very impactful.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a really good cover. I like it a lot, and I liked this publisher, Ig Press, particularly when I first saw their covers, because all of their covers, they have such a statement.
Right.
And that does. And I love the large boy. Yeah.
The tendency when a kid kills is to only look at the severity of the crime, to define the teen only by that crime, and to demand what we feel the future should hold for the perpetrators. We only look back perfunctorily, if at all, at how kids turned into violent offenders, let alone take any societal responsibility for how we, as adults, created the environment and communicated the cultural messages in which their characters were formed, their attitudes undirected, and their fears unassuaged.
This cover says it very starkly. The way that Carter talks about being heavily influenced by the need to appear tough, the need to feel that he's standing up for his friends and to show people that he's not going to back down,
mm-hmm.
whether it's his friends, whether it's authority figures. Is there anything particular about American culture and the messages it sends to boys that perhaps reinforce those kinds of pretty typical teenage boy mentality, but that perhaps reinforce it sometimes for some boys who are vulnerable?
Have you heard the movie or maybe the book called The Outsider? It's very much a story of someone who feels wronged and who takes the law into his own hands and thinks he's going to be a hero. But, in fact, he is not perceived that way. Well, in the movie he is, but Carter imagined that he would be perceived that way, too. Because if he stood up for somebody, then he would be right. The value of loyalty to your friends, perhaps more important than some kind of thing someone else might deem as morality. I don't know what exactly to call it, but for Carter, that loyalty was everything. And so... yeah, I do think he got that message. When he was behind bars, he told me that there was a film he watched which really touched him and that I should watch it. And it was called Tough Guys, T-O-U-G-H-G-U-I-S-E, Tough Guys. and it's by Jackson Katz. And the film is really about how we get these messages from the media that we have to be, well, particularly the young men, have to be tough. And that is part of what it is to be a man. And Carter said when he saw that video, and it was in prison, it really helped him understand what had happened to him and why he felt that way, because he was so inculcated with those messages from the media, from his school, from his friends, from his father, from everything. And so, absolutely, American society.
S.E. Hinton's book, The Outsiders, written and published in the mid-1960s when she was an Oklahoma teenager herself, is a raw and honest account of the interactions of adolescent boys, whatever their socioeconomic backgrounds. The defiance of rules, their sometimes swaggering attempts to establish an identity and group allegiance and acceptance, their striving for recognition of that identity by insiders and outsiders, and their bragging and posturing both to those who identify with them and to those who are perceived as representing a different and sometimes hostile group identity. The Outsiders is also a sensitive and astute exposé of teenage boys' vulnerabilities, their emotional attachments and brotherly affection-fueled loyalties, their disillusionments, their fears and sadness, and how, despite their dismissive and seemingly indifferent attitude towards their parents, parental disinterest or emotional and physical abuse hurts them deeply and can become a catalyst for forming misguided compensatory relationships and carrying out rash, tension-releasing actions. The book was made into a film in 1983 and brings to life Hinton's characters, who are far from one-dimensional hooligans. Those who are outwardly rough and aggressive, like the central character Dallas, who's the role model for the members of the Greaser Gang on how to defy authority, provoke distaste in girls, arouse fear in children, and generally create exhilarating havoc, are also capable of concern, protectiveness, and emotional devastation when those they have adopted as informal family members are in danger or are harmed. Likewise, the seemingly softer and perhaps more cerebral characters, like Ponyboy and Johnny, will also react with verbal hostility if they feel misunderstood or disrespected, or with physical violence if they or someone they are close to is being threatened or attacked. The complexity of the characters defies pigeonholing them as dispensable, destructive youth who have no worth. The focus isn't on redemption. The characters don't really change during the arc of the story, which only spans a few days in the lives of these Oklahoma kids. But the juxtaposition and balance of both destructive and redeeming characteristics gives us a realistic picture of young people who are not all bad, even if they can at times be very bad. We see that the terrible acts they sometimes carry out are often more a result of momentary, immature, reactionary impetuosity and untethered, raw, emotional volatility than they are of sustained, ruthless, morally corrupt and soulless calculation. Carter Reed's story bears many of the hallmarks of the dynamics in The Outsiders.
Another thing you've talked about is how his irrational action, not thinking it through, just barging into the classroom with his friends, was so childlike, yeah, and so immature, which just demonstrates the immaturity of the right act, the lack of planning, the lack of seeing what the consequences would be in the end, which in mm-hmm. and of itself prove the immaturity mm-hmm. of the minds that went into that event. The film, to me, ties in with that, in that it's kind of an idealized, fantasized idea of loyalty and toughness.
And manhood.
Right, holding on to a fictional mm-hmm. idea of loyalty and manhood.
And Carter was not big. He was slight also. That's important, too. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't good athletically. His father was an athlete, and he wasn't an athlete. Mm-hmm. And his father always made him feel like he wasn't an athlete. But when he got into prison, he started working out and, again, kind of overcompensated, becoming very fit and very concerned with how much weight he could lift and, you know, a lot of that stuff. So he went through that in prison, too, and I think he also saw that that was part of his response.
Presumably also that was a self-protection mm-hmm. mechanism. Mm-hmm. Did he get brutalized physically in prison at all, or was
no.
he threatened?
He had some pretty creepy cellmates at certain points who did kind of threaten him, but not really life-threatening or anything that dangerous. He saw some fights, but he really didn't participate in many. He kind of got out of the way.
How did he manage to avoid fights?
There are different ways. You not necessarily fight physically. I mean, sometimes there's, you know, I'm over here, you're over there, don't come near me.
Posturing.
I'm on this side of the room. You know, this guy has my back. Carter also has had, I don't think now, but he had a bullying side to him, too. You know, when you've been bullied, I think you also have the potential to become a bully. And he tried that, too, in prison. I tell one story in the book when he bullied a pedophile. That was somebody he could bully because everybody hated that person. I think young people have different ways they react. Some of them become this tough guy, or try to be, and some of them get terrorized. They're all sort of reactions to the situation.
Just like in the story in The Outsiders, the attitudes and the actions of the boys in Carter's story both repel us and arouse our empathy. If you acknowledge the multifaceted and widely fluctuating developmentally unfinished nature of teenagers, it makes it all the harder when considering what the fate of young killers should be. It's much easier to simply dismiss them as evil and condemn them to the worst punishment available. Much easier to pretend that they're a different species from any kids we know or parent.
It's very difficult for people to be interested in someone who has harmed someone else. That's not easy. It's much easier to be interested in someone who has been harmed. We assume if someone harms someone else that there's often maliciousness attached to it, or that that person doesn't have a story that leads to them harming, and that that isn't something that we might end up being sympathetic about. But in fact, it's true. So I think that's, you know, it's hard to find sympathy when someone has killed a person.
And I think perhaps if you make a character sympathetic, like you've humanized Carter, mm-hmm. I think if you make a person sympathetic, that's even worse for some people, I think, because it's a cognitive dissonance that mm-hmm. they don't want to feel that that mm-hmm. person has any redeeming qualities.
I think that it's hard to see that someone who hurt your family then goes on to get a voice and lives basically a life. In some way, you want their life. I mean, I'm not saying this is how I feel, but in some way, there's a sense that when you think of it through the eyes of somebody who's seeking vengeance or what they call justice, I don't call justice, but why should that person get a chance when my loved one did not? They don't think that anyone who kills should be given another chance, and they don't believe that people can be redeemed through their actions and through their change in attitudes in life.
Carter is a fairly unique relationship that
it wasn't a plan.
Developed.
It was just Carter became the face for juvenile justice, for me, an example of what was wrong with the system.
Now, does he do speaking engagements?
Sometimes.
Is he involved in the movement to get parole?
He wants to be involved more and more. That's something that's important to him, to speak out. He's very much against kids being sent to adult prisons.
Is he on life parole?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how free is he to move around the country? For example, if he were invited to do a speaking engagement, how free is he to move around?
He has to get permission from the parole board to go out of state. Everything has an effect on the people who are on parole because people pull back and they get scared and things change.
Jean Trounstein's book, Boy with a Knife, is a testament to the viability of change and an endorsement of the notion that rather than throwing away teenagers for life, society can benefit from allowing them to step back and make good when they are ready. As she says, it's not about excusing the crime. The juvenile lifers across the country, many who killed, now waiting to be resentenced and in many cases released, mostly middle-aged and elderly men, have been punished. And the ones who will be released have demonstrated during decades in prison that they have been capable of remorse and rehabilitation.
In one of your interviews, you said, to be a better society, we need to be a deeper society.
Well, I think it goes to this notion of there's a bad kid and there's a good kid. There's a bad this and there's a good this. We tend to simplify in our minds in order to deal with our feelings a lot about things. So that we have a child who was killed. Horrible. So immediately, the person who killed the child is the monster that we have to go after. And it's that simplicity of thinking that destroys complexity of a problem. And the complexity is in the problem. It's not going away whether we label it this way or not. But the complexity is that this child who killed another child is in his own way. He's not a victim, but he may very well have been a victim at one point. And there is some kind of story he has, some kind of pain he has, some kind of horrible way in which he is acting out whatever it is that he's doing. And we build a different narrative, which is to simplify it and make it bad as opposed to human. And it's that humanity which really makes us deeper, seeing the bigger picture. You have to broaden the picture rather than make the picture narrow. And it's broadening the picture that allows us, I guess, and this is what I meant by deeper, that allows us to more fully appreciate the full humanity of each of the people in these situations that we encounter. I think that's the only way we can really heal. And I think ultimately that's the way we have to look at harm.
You've been listening to Juvie, conceived, written, and produced by Zoe Badafini. Join us next time on Juvie.